From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's not uncommon to see a public television program or magazine article about the impact human development is having on wildlife. And typically, those shows or stories take you to a national park or a wildlife refuge, an undisturbed and astonishing habitat unlike any you could imagine living in yourself. Though we hear a lot less about urban ecology, it's not always the case that the least disturbed places on Earth always have the most birds. In fact, says Dr. John Marsluff in his new book, Welcome to Suburbia, the greatest variety of birds is often found in the suburbs, where we humans are found in great density, too. It's certainly true that not all birds do well living with us, but some species have adapted and actually even thrived. So why is that, and what can we do as human neighbors to foster more such success stories? Dr. John Marsluff is a renowned ornithologist and urban ecologist and professor of wildlife sciences at the University of Washington, and now he's also the author of Welcome to Suburbia from Yale University Press, his fifth book. In his research, he applies a behavioral approach to conservation issues and has particular expertise in crows, ravens, jays, and their relatives, as well as in birds of prey. I'm so glad to have you here today, John Marsluff, and I'm so enjoying the book, so thank you and congratulations on it. Welcome.
Thanks, Margaret. Pleasure to be here.
Yes. And so you're out in Washington, yes? And how's the season progressing there? Is it what's going on there bird-wise?
Bird-wise, we've basically had the migrations come through.
Here, too.
Maybe a few still hanging on. I heard of a vireo yesterday. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we're settling into kind of the winter routine and welcoming golden-crowned sparrows and varied thrush and things like that into our yards.
Yeah, same here. The last I had a funny juvenile, a phoebe, you know, with the kind of pale yellow to the breast, kind of looking like, what am I doing here? Am I supposed to be somewhere else over the weekend? And you know, and then the juncos are settling in and so forth. So, you know, this is a very interesting book and timely because, as you point out in it, by 2050, two-thirds of humans are going to live in cities. So we're moving into greater density. And how are the birds going to be doing? And it's, well, I guess what surprised me most about the book is how optimistic the tone is. You know, even though you're candid about the rate of songbird decline in some environments, this is a very, there's a lot of enthusiasm and positive thoughts in this book, too.
Well, I'm glad you pick up on that. I think it is an important aspect. There's a lot of great diversity of birds and plants as well in urban areas, and to just write that off and not celebrate and enjoy it, I think, is a mistake.
Yes. Or you spend a lot, you do a lot of your research, not in the wild wilderness, but in fact tracking birds in these suburban and even urban environments, yes?
Yes, that's true. I mean, I enjoy the wilderness as much as anybody and,
yes.
and get there whenever I can. And certainly, as you pointed out, there are some birds and many mammals that absolutely require that. But much of our research has been right here in the kind of urbanizing front of Seattle as it grows east into the Cascade Mountains, trying to understand really how the bird communities change there and what it means for the people that live there as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe midway through the new book, you write, rapid, explosive evolution in response to the novel environments humans create is the new normal. And so, of course, I, a layperson, think of, you know, anything involving evolution is taking, you know, centuries or millennia. But you're talking about something different, about birds that are demonstrating successful strategies for changing a little faster, yes?
Absolutely. It's been well documented in, of course, insects and fish and things like that, rapid evolutionary change. And I mean, substantial genetic changes in the matter of a few decades. And now we know that's also the case for some birds. And the places you expect that rapid change are where natural selection is acting strongly. And that's in our urban places, among others. But here, you know, because of our actions, the pollutants and things like that we add, but also the opportunities and changed land covers that we provide, those are strong selective forces on the animals that are able to survive with us, and they change accordingly.
So decades, you're saying that some animals can respond, and is this physical changes or behavioral changes? Like, let's have some examples of what these are like.
I'll give you an example of each. There's a lot of behavioral changes, and those are, you know, the first steps in adapting and evolving. But one of my favorite behavioral changes involves some of the birds that are taking advantage of our new food situation. So, for example, we have a bird here called the Brewer's Blackbird, and it's a very common bird that lives in open areas. In our part of the world, it's preferred habitat, as far as I can tell, is a Costco parking lot. And these guys love these parking lots and the little fringing shrubs around them, and I was curious of how they didn't get run over, you know, living in these parking lots as they do. They're right in around your cars. So I went early one morning to study them, and the birds weren't there. And in fact, they didn't show up till 5 minutes of 10, and the store opens at 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And these birds had learned our schedule and were there just in time to line up with the first shoppers to sneak into Costco as soon as the doors opened. They get into the cafe and eat, they stay warm and dry, and they've behaviorally adapted to this sort of activity of ours and place of ours.
Wow. Wow. So that's a rapid behavioral change to adapt to a
yes.
new situation, a new food opportunity in that case. Okay.
Right. And a good example of a morphological or a physical change involves the dark-eyed junco, as you mentioned, what
yes.
a lot of people call the snowbird.
Mm-hmm.
So as they've come in to live more and more in our cities and even breed in a lot of our suburbs, they have a different strategy there. The females are exerting a strong force on the coloration of the males, and in the wild parts of their range, the females prefer males that are very aggressive, and an aggressive male is also one that has a lot of white feathering in its tail.
Oh.
But that pays off in the wild land because you want a male that can defend the territory that you're breeding in as a female so you can raise your one or maybe two broods a summer. But in the suburbs, a female junco can pull off three, four, five broods in a year. And females in the suburbs are selecting for males that are not so aggressive, but are more mellow, more able to withstand the stress of the urban environment, and more attentive to their young. And these males also have less white in their tail because the males flash the white at one another when
yes.
they are aggressive. So over time, in 20 years in San Diego, an awesome study done by Pamela Yeh showed that the amount of white in the junco's tail has evolved from about three feathers to just over two feathers.
It's in 20 years?
20 years.
Wow. Wow. That is a fast physiological change, morphological change. That's pretty fast. Again,
and physiological. Yeah. Actually, yeah, you're right. They've changed their ability to respond to stress as well.
Wow. You know, as a small detour for a second, you were talking about male and female juncos, and I have to admit that even though I'm surrounded by juncos in large numbers, I live in a rural environment at this time in my life, in the winter time, I don't actually know how to tell a male from a female. And I
yeah.
think of the bird as just having that white flash, you know, in its tail. When you see it fly away, you see that distinctive whiteness in the tail. How do you tell them apart? Are they easy to tell apart?
Well, you know, there are so many different morphs of
yes.
juncos. They're a little bit confusing, but
okay.
in general, most of them have a rather dark hood, a lighter underbelly, and
yeah.
a dark back.
So,
and
yeah.
the contrast with that hood and the underbelly and the rest of the bird is striking in a male.
Okay.
And it's not as striking in a female.
Okay.
It almost looks like they don't have a hood.
Okay. All right. So it is. It's the intensity of that compared to
yes.
the rest of the... Oh, okay. Okay, good. So I'm
yes.
going to look more closely as everybody settles in for feeder season at my house.
Yeah, and see if you can see how much white they have on their
yeah.
tails when they flick them out.
Yes, yes. So some, you know, now, just not to paint too rosy a picture, not every bird is able to do what the Brewer's Blackbird did in that example or the dark-eyed junco did in the other example. I mean, some birds have not found this kind of adjustment easy. So are there some sort of examples on the other side of birds that are missing now, the more suburban and urban habitat? I mean, yes, of course there are, but are there some good ones like that by contrast?
Yes.
Yeah.
And in general, Rob Blair at University of Minnesota has called these avoiders of urban area. I think
avoiders.
It's a good way to think about
yes.
it. Yes. They decline in our presence. They include some birds that are fairly common elsewhere, like the hairy woodpecker, but it declines generally around us. A few will live with us, but most don't. Another species that's familiar probably to most of us in North America is the Wilson's warbler, mm-hmm. a small yellow bird with a nice black cap in the male that nests on the ground and migrates down to Central America and Mexico. And this bird also declines in our presence. So those are good examples. Cavity nesters, woodpeckers in general,
okay.
A lot of them have trouble around us because we don't leave enough dead trees.
Right.
And ground nesters also, like the warbler, have trouble around us because of more predators on the ground.
Okay. So there are common factors that explain why certain species can't become avoiders or can't make these quick adjustments because of perhaps their reproductive habits, as you just were saying.
And also, they're just generally less flexible
mm-hmm.
in their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Think about a crow, a bird that really does well with us, extremely flexible, can eat just about anything and nest just about anywhere.
Yes, they can eat anything. My sister loves to call me when she has put out pizza crusts from the night before onto her compost heap, and she's like, they're flying away with the pizza crusts, Margaret. And it is just the funniest, becomes sort of a family joke, you know, it's like when, quote, her crows are having pizza.
Right.
But, you know, they are. They're just amazing and so talkative as well. I know you have a particular expertise, as I said in the introduction, in the corvids, and they are saw a big raven today as I was coming to the studio, and I thought about you and thought, you know, about your love of them. I have a love of them,
yeah.
too. Yeah.
What a great bird.
Yeah, they are characters. So some other adaptable birds. I mean, are song sparrows adaptable? That's a bird that appears in the book a number of times, for example.
Song sparrows and rufous-sided towhees or spotted mm-hmm. towhees out in the west, they're very adaptable. They kind of tolerate what we do to the land. We captured and marked thousands of these birds with bands, and we found the same bird coming back to the same place and breeding year after year in people's backyards, even in newly developing subdivisions where the land cover went from basically forest to a suburban setting in a matter of a few years. The song sparrows and towhees stuck right with it, and made use of the new resources that we provide in feeders and things like that, and the new juxtaposition of forest and kind of edgy landscaped land cover as well.
Mm-hmm. I love the towhees, and I noticed you call them rufous-sided, which is what I call them, but in some of the new books I see, they call them, I think ERs, they call an eastern towhee maybe, or something. Anyway, it had a name that didn't seem familiar to me. The way I learned it was rufous-sided.
I think the rufous-sided has been split into what we
yeah.
call spotted here and you call eastern there.
I see. Okay. It's a great bird, and I love that in the springtime when the snow has melted and I see and the leaves are starting to dry that are still on the ground, and I see that characteristic, like suddenly there's this funny little motion and action and leaves flying in the garden beds or whatever, and I spy it, and sure enough, there they are kicking up the
yeah.
looking around for something to eat. They're
exactly.
wonderful birds. Yeah. So I guess it would be good to kind of shift then to, so here we are. We've had some examples of birds who have adapted and not, but, you know, we're here and we're, as I said in the beginning, just moving closer and closer in to the cities and suburbs as a human population. But what are the things that we can be doing? And so I loved, you opened one section of the book with a quote from the great conservationist, sort of the father of wildlife management, I guess, Aldo Leopold, the quote that says, "My land is a community." And I think overall, that's a great philosophical sort of answer to what can we do as humans to make a more hospitable environment, is to think of our land as a community. But there's particular things that you also recommend that are a little more practical. So can we talk about those?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the valuing it as a community and not simply a commodity, as Leopold said, is the underlying philosophy of a sustainable land ethic that definitely applies in our suburban as well as agricultural settings where Leopold was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
In the suburban areas, we can do things to increase the quality of the land for birds, and the most simple thing to do there is to keep that diversity and make it even more diverse. And with respect to the places we live, grass is kind of the enemy of diversity. It's a uniform, two-dimensional thing, and it really doesn't support full life for any particular bird. Some may forage there, but none do everything there. So
right,
reducing lawn.
Right. It doesn't support insect life either. And if aren't the majority of bird species at least partially insectivorous? Or I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. So
and especially during the breeding season when they're raising young.
Yeah. If you don't grow bugs, you can't grow birds, right? I mean, when I get really like completely basic, that's what I say to myself as I'm marching around and thinking, what can I do to make it better for the birds? I think grow more bugs.
I think that's absolutely the key. And we know from studies that native vegetation has more bugs that are relevant for
yes.
birds than non-native.
Yes.
But even non-native vegetation does produce a lot of good things, berries and nuts and,
yes.
and nectar and things that and some insects that birds use. So that's good. It's a better step than grass, but the best would be to go to a more native vegetation. It adds structure, places
mm-hmm.
to hide and nest, as well as food.
And so that structure is important because that. And you talked about the two-dimensionality of grass. So when we have where grass meets a 40-foot tree, there's
yeah.
not there's something missing. There's that ecotone,
yeah.
that edge is missing, right? And that's an important area.
And it's easy to add, and it's beautiful when you add it as well. So it takes away from the kind of savanna look that
yeah.
people like, but it adds to the complexity that the rest of nature requires.
Yeah. I've been fascinated. I'm a gardener. I've been a gardener for 30-something years, and I have a lot of non-native plants in my landscape. And this year, a new one on me, a native bird interested in a non-native plant that I've grown for a long time. It's a southeastern native. It's a chestnut relative, a large shrub called Aesculus parviflora, the bottle brush buckeye. And I watched a group of orioles at flowering time in July on this huge shrub, orioles investigating the flowers, you know, as I see them do in apple blossom time and wild cherry blossom time. You know, they kind of seem interested in the flowers. And that was, you know, again, it's not, just as you said, sometimes things aren't exactly native, but there can be wildlife interest.
Yes, they can provide important resources like that. And that allows also birds the opportunity to adapt to these new food resources. So
yeah.
a lot of hummingbirds have adapted to our non-native plants for the same reason you described with the oriole, and that's
yes.
allowed them to shift their range and live more with us.
Yes. So we're going to then, we're just saying no to so much lawn. That's a good
right.
important step. We're going to increase the sort of edge, the ecotone, the in-between environment. What else are we doing? And maybe
well,
we're upping
in that,
it. Yeah.
In that same vein of habitat, again, allowing dead trees or dead parts of trees to remain where that's
right.
safe. That's key for woodpeckers. And woodpeckers are facilitators in their ecosystem, and it's, I should say, our ecosystem. And in that way, they're drilling holes or putting sap wells in trees that other animals use and that things like chickadees and nuthatches and swallows nest in.
Mm-hmm.
So having a more healthy woodpecker population buys you a lot more than just woodpeckers, but they need dead trees.
Uh-huh. And also leaving some brush, even if you don't have a snag, a standing dead tree, not being quite so scrupulously tidy, obsessively tidy
yeah.
can be helpful, yes?
Very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think brush piles are key. The species that we share, the winter wren in your part of the world, the
yes.
Pacific wren here, absolutely requires those brush piles. And
yeah.
it's a small bird with a great song that you can enjoy, but it's not going to be there if you don't have some brushy areas.
I look forward to the winter wren every year. So in the last, like, you know, 3-4 minutes or so, I want to talk about two points that are very important in the book, and they're really kind of things that you recommend that we can do to kind of not to limit the death of birds as opposed to feeding. And those are things that it's hard for people to believe, but they're very important. Give us some of the numbers about the effect of cats and window strikes.
Yeah, cats that roam outside have been estimated to kill between 1 and 4 billion birds per year in the United States.
Billion.
That's about 1 in every 10 birds killed by a cat, and that's a preventable death for sure. Cats also live longer inside than outside, so it's better for the cat. And if your cat is an outside cat, you can consider leashes. Or you can consider catteries or bibs and things like this that can be put on them to reduce their ability to catch birds. But even if they're out wandering around and not catching them, they're disturbing nesting birds, and that leads to nest failure in a dramatic way. So keeping our cats inside is rule number one if you want to really help your local birds.
Yes.
And then the window strikes you mentioned, that's the second leading source of mortality for birds in the world. And about 500 million birds per year are killed in the United States by colliding with our residential windows. And, you know, that's the typical house might take out 2 or 3 birds a year, which I'm sure many of the listeners would appreciate as, just about right for what I've seen. And you can reduce that mortality by having panes on your windows or screening or netting on the outside works really well. Or even ultraviolet reflective stickers, which don't obscure our view too much, but do make the window visible to birds because birds see in the ultraviolet spectrum as well as the visible spectrum that we see in.
So the netting, it has to be stretched tight, and it's a little bit away from the window, or how does it?
I think that's the, from what I've heard, is really the most effective thing.
Yeah.
So, like, think about cup hooks on the outside surrounding your window, and
good
you
idea.
Take the netting you would kind of normally put on your shrubs to keep birds out of the berries and stretch it very taut. It's virtually invisible to you from the from looking outside through the window. But birds either see it, or if they do hit it, they are kind of cushioned like a trampoline.
Right.
So it's very effective, and especially where you have a window that maybe a lot of birds hit, or it's close to a feeder. Something like that is really effective.
Yeah, I've started putting my feeders like in excess of 25 feet or so away from the house. Do you know what I mean? Or either that or right next to the house, which seems to also, somewhere in that mid-distance, if it's just a few feet away or 6 feet, they're coming in at high speed, and they sometimes, I guess, get a poor image. You know, they think the feeder's where it's not or something, and they hit. So I've started moving the feeders too,
Keeping them out and planting vegetation on the outside but not having plants on the inside that the birds see helps because they'll land in front of the windows instead of going to what they appear as to them as a plant in, you know, that's right there, but it's separated from you from them by the glass. That's also an effective planting strategy.
Well, I'm fascinated. I don't live in suburbia. I live in, as I said, in a rural area, John Marsloff, but I'm fascinated by the book. I'm really enjoying it, and I thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about this sort of examples of rapid evolution by some birds who are successful, some others who unfortunately are not, and also some of these tips for how we can, you know, be better neighbors to the birds. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Margaret. Thank you.
Okay. And thanks to the rest of you for joining me, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden or at awaytogarden.com. Happy gardening and birding meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.